If you're in my class or have been in my class, can you say what's up? Hello. Yeah. All right. So I'm actually going to read some fiction. I write fiction in secret. In thinking about the set and similar to what Marguerite did, I was thinking about the work that Tim had. And in the conversation that we had earlier today at San Francisco State at 1 p.m., I was thinking about names and numbers and how oftentimes people of color were seen as bodies. We're seen as bodies and were minimalized to just numbers. There are 28 people who perished in that plane, the plane crash, who their names were fought for. Who here is familiar with the 43 missing students of Mexico? Can you name all of them? You can't, and it's hard. Close to 7 decades ago, and the 43 students that disappeared in 2014. Atrocities like this still happen, and they will continue to happen. This is a story that I wrote a long time ago. By long, I mean like 4 years ago. So this is textbook Spanish for traveling abroad. On her way to class, the girl sees a bright neon blue poster advertising a study abroad program in Guerrero, Mexico. The girl took Spanish in high school and enjoyed every moment. Instantly, her mind is fixated on Mexico. She visited once during spring break and regrets not using the Spanish she learned in class. She could go back, learn more Spanish, better Spanish, authentic Spanish. She hesitates taking down the information. The program she's in wouldn't have that many courses in Mexico. She didn't do that well in the classes she took in high school, but she stares at the flyer fervently and takes a tear off. Later that night, she calls her mother to plead the cultural investment of studying abroad for a year in Mexico. "I think it's a good idea, Mom. You know how much I like Spanish in high school. I'd like learn more if I was actually there, you know," she says. "Baby, please. It's not safe down there. Why not France? Learn some better French. You always liked French," the mother responds. "I've never taken a French class in my life. It's just regional stuff anyway. My friend who has family there says everything is okay. You just have to know the right people, not go into the bad places," the girl says. "I'm not convinced. I read articles on Facebook every other day about a woman being found dead or some journalist going missing and turning up into pieces days later," the mom replies. "It's a misconception that we have here in the States, Mom. It's safe. Believe me. Remember Ramona? She went to Mexico to visit family during the summer. She barely spoke any Spanish and was more American than me. She came back fine. She wasn't at a university or resort or any other place where I'm going to be," the girl says. "Honey, I'm still worried. Can you please reconsider?" "Mom, it's a school, like in students. Students don't get killed. Do you honestly believe that cartels would kill students for some fly or something, their tuition money, or their frightening 8-page papers? Do you know what they do to people down there? Do you know how many people come into my office every day from Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador? They tell me things that happen to their friends, family, the people they love. Baby girl, please reconsider," the mom says. "Mom," the girl says, "it's okay. Trust me, you're my mom. You don't have to play immigration lawyer right now. Can we talk more about this?" "Yeah, Mom, of course." The two of them go back and forth. It starts with a phone call, and soon those calls become Skype sessions with both her parents. When winter break begins, she returns home with colorful pamphlets from the study abroad office. She spends the duration of her vacation fighting for her parents' approval. The girl shows them the school website, colorfully decorated in teenage students of all races wearing their university sweaters. Other photos go into detail about the history of the host university and amenities for students from the States. She stresses to her parents that the trip will be safe, but more importantly, it offers her the chance to replace her textbook Spanish with authentic Spanish, the Spanish she wants to speak. The night before Christmas, her parents make a decision. They write on a small piece of paper, fold it, place it in an envelope, and hide it in their Christmas tree. In the morning, the family takes turns opening presents. The girl's father points out the envelope and says she is to open the first present out of all of them. The girl plucks the cotton paper envelope from the tree, expecting a check from her parents or grandparents. She opens and finds a small piece of paper with Feliz Navidad written on it. With her mother's cursive, a check for the study abroad application, and funds for an airplane ticket fall out. The girl jumps to hug her parents in excitement. The girl has had extensive practice in the language, but is far from fluent and is far from being able to take instruction in it. She asks her counselor if a Spanish course during the spring would count towards her degree. His answer is no, if she wants to graduate on time and 4 years like everybody else wants. She ponders if it's worth taking a private Spanish course somewhere in the city. Private tutors are out of the question. Her parents write her checks for living expenses and school. Anything extra would mean she'd have to pick up a part-time job. She finds an intense summer session in Iguala for Americans that advertises a remedy for textbook Spanish. She'll have to show up 6 weeks before the semester begins, giving up her summer break. She is willing to exchange the parties, the shopping, and her friends for this chance in Mexico. For an authentic tongue, she would forego anything. She arrives in Mexico and refuses to play the part of the tourist. She is not here for sightseeing, a foreign fling to tell her sororities, or photos to fill her album on Facebook. All of that is too American, too cliche, just like photos of Mexico in her high school textbook had. She makes her intentions clear to herself. She will learn Spanish. Her tongue will be indistinguishable. When she returns and speaks with someone who is from Argentina, Spain, Chile, or the Dominican Republic, they will know that she speaks Mexican Spanish, not some convoluted, formal, ugly tongue taught from a book. She makes friends quickly, avoiding other Americans in the summer seminar. The girl opts to try her luck meeting locals. Her language skills aren't so great, but after a while, she begins to pick up the language the way that she wants. Little by little, her brain absorbs the contractions, conjugations, and idioms. She has an advantage over the Americans in class. She knows how to roll her R's, make a huh with the J's, and knows that C's in the middle can make a soft S sound. The more she practices, the more the language takes over her body. She begins to see language everywhere. The words on billboards begin to make sense. There are no longer letters organized into words that she has to look up. The sounds on her mouth are beginning to flow like water. When she speaks English, her Northern Californian accent is evident. She wants the same for her Spanish. She listens to conversations strangers have on the street, noting their hand gestures, the way their lips move, and the bright in their eyes as they speak their language. This is the reason why she's here, to be part of all of this around her. As the girl improves her skills, she finds it easier to communicate and makes friends. Nights in the town of Iguala are bright and colorful with so many places to eat. History is written on the walls and people are indeed friendly. Every so often, she'll go out with new friends to eat some authentic food and practice her authentic Spanish. One particular night, while reading for a class, she notices a boy not much older than her sobbing in the corner. He's dirty and he hasn't showered in days. His white t-shirt is stained with brown and red. He has no drink and no company and he weeps in silence. "I'm gonna go see if that guy is all right," the girl tells the friend that she's sitting with. "Who?" the friend asks, looking around the crowded building. "Him, over there, you see him. He's in the corner, he's crying, he doesn't look all right. I'm gonna go check on him, say hey, see if he needs anything." The girl says, motioning her head in the direction of the crying boy. "Him? He looks roughed up. You should stay away. He looks like he got into a fight." "Bad news," her friend says. "No, I'll be okay. I'm pretty sure I can help. Just let me talk to him." "You Americans and your helping. Do what you want. But if you get into trouble, look over here and I'll step in. Sounds good?" Her friend looks her in the eyes and waits until she nods in the agreement. "I got this," the girl says. She prepares her words in her mind, ready to offer solace, if any, to the boy across the cafe. In her mind, she has carefully selected her words, her sentence structure, and the level of enthusiasm, some vernacular to make him comfortable. He's a stranger, so she'll have to use some formalities. As she moves towards him, she's able to make out the writing on his shirt, Ayotzinapa, is written across it. She recognizes it as a rural teachers program that teaches young, that trains young men in agricultural areas to be grade school teachers for their communities. He's a college student, just like her. "Hello, I saw you crying. Are you okay? May I buy you something?" she asked the boy, her concern translated. "I'm fine. Go away. I'm tired. Just want to go home," he says as he lays his head on the table. His brown face is caked with old tear stains. He has been crying for a long time. Something doesn't feel right to the girl. She has never seen eyes like this, devoid of any brightness. The brown has faded into a milky gray wax of sorrow. "Can I do anything to help you? I insist," the girl pushes on. "You can help me by leaving me alone," he says. "I'm sorry, I will go. I hope that you feel better soon, though," the girl says. These are the best words that she's able to offer the boy. Embarrassed, she walks back to her table in defeat. "How'd it go?" her friend asks. "I don't think I should have done that," the girl says. "Something feels really wrong." Next to her table sits a woman, red all over her face, who's staring at her, judging, angry. "Who do you think you are?" the woman says. "I beg your pardon?" the girl says. "Look at him. Who do you think you are? This isn't America. He was with the group 3 days ago." The woman yells and the cafe goes silent, all eyes on them. "I don't understand. I didn't mean to offend," the girl replies with defense on her tongue. "Didn't you hear? Everyone knows. He was almost on that bus, almost on that fucking bus. He could have been one of them. There were more than 43. They only got 43. Have some fucking respect." "I'm sorry, I don't know what's going on. I'm only here for a year," the girl says as she's cut off mid-sentence. "Really? You don't pay attention to the world around you? You don't notice anything at your school on the fucking streets?" The woman scribbles a name on the napkin and slams it on the table. "Type this name on your fucking computer, your phone, or whatever the fuck you have. Look what they've done to us. Do you know his name? Everyone's saying his name." The girl reads the name on the napkin. "Julio Cesar Mondragon." She shakes her head side to side at the woman. "You don't know his name, but you've been living here. Are you fucking blind to what's around? You don't know his name? You stupid, stupid girl. You'll know his name by morning. Everyone is saying it, and you'll know it too." The woman storms off, slamming the cafe door as she exits, and people begin to follow her. "Wow. What a bitch," the friend says. "What's going on? I don't know what's going on," the girl asks. "There's some talk of an attack or something. I'm not keeping up with it. Classes have been pretty rough. I did notice half my classes were canceled today for some reason," her friend says, scratching his beard. "Maybe we find out later at the university?" "Yeah, maybe. Will you be all right taking the bus back to school, or do you need me to go with you?" the friend asks. "I think I'll be fine," the girl says. "Suit yourself," the friend replies. The two say goodbyes, and soon she finds herself waiting at her bus stop. As she waits for the bus, she notices the somber tone of the downtown as people pass her. She attempts to eavesdrop. She's now fluent in that, too. Every group that passes by talks quickly and with urgency. Group after group, she keeps hearing the same words, students, students, estudiantes. She wonders about the value of the name on the napkin. She should have thrown it away. The woman in cafe handed it to her so rudely, after all. Called her a stupid, stupid girl. Her pocket begins to feel hot, as if it's calling for it to find out. She checks her phone. The bus will come in 5 minutes, but the napkin grows hotter and hotter, wanting to burst into violent flames. She doesn't want to walk back to the dorms, but she's compelled to because something is wrong. The closer she gets to campus, the more she hears the words students, estudiantes, and sees people running around. People are crying, some are screaming, and others are on their phones yelling at the top of their lungs. Soon she finds herself running full speed. She enters her room and alone types the name Julio Cesar Mondragon. She filters posts from that same day. She goes to the images section, not able to find any articles. She sees him there in a photo, uncensored. He is sprawled out on the ground, his pants down a little so that his boxers are showing, red shirt pulled up halfway, exposing his belly button. His hand is on his stomach and his face has been torn off. Maybe it's a Halloween prop. Maybe some animal was cut up, a prank. She looks closer. The image is real. It is a man with his face flayed off to bone. She rushes to the bathroom, tripping almost all over all the clothes on the floor. She grasps the rim of the toilet and holds herself as she begins to throw up. She vomits all the food she's had today. After all the food has been purged, she dry heaves saliva and stomach fluids into the toilet. And even after she can give no more, she continues to gag over the rim. Soon, warm red drops of thick red liquid begin to trickle from her mouth. She spits one last time. It's thick and warmer than usual, and it tastes like a dirty penny. In the dark of the bathroom, she sobs. She wonders what her mother is doing in that moment. For the first time since she arrived in Mexico, she feels alone and foreign. She falls asleep, curled up in a tiny ball in her bathroom, and she hears the words repeat and repeat over again, "Stupid, stupid girl." She sees him in a dream. She sees him the first night, and then he visits her every single night after. The reoccurring dream is always the same. She knows that he is going to die. This is his story that has been told to her, his last moments. She followed the news after all the next day. He comes to her every night and he's crying, begging police officers for mercy. He is young. He has a wife and daughter. All he wants to do is see them again. He apologizes over and over again, but they don't listen. They don't question. They don't want any information. They don't ask his name or where he's from or what he was trying to do. He is tied up and he has been chosen as the only body that will be found. The others will be shot and burned and buried in a mass grave. He is elegido. He is chosen. His body needs to send a message to all of Mexico. They begin with his eyes. That's their favorite part. They stab into the socket underneath the eyeball and swiftly pop it out like you do a fish, and they repeat for the other. He wants to scream loud for someone, anyone to hear, and he's still alive as they begin with a knife, starting under his chin and working their way up. His arms are tied behind his back, and his nails dig into whatever flesh they touch. His legs thrash, his toes and his shoes contract so tightly that the toenails pierce the inside of them. Soon he goes still, and when they're done, they leave, and that's it. And they take a photo, and they send it out to the world. This is the dream she dreams every night when he comes to visit her. It's been 2 weeks. When she wakes, she looks out the window and into the campus quad below. The news spread like wildfire. All the classes are canceled. The people have begun their war cry. Hundreds of university students have made signs, painted their face, covered themselves in blood and protest nonstop from sunrise to sunset. When she asks the question, the reply is the same from person to person. The 43, it's about the 43 that never came back, one person says. They took them and we want them back. Another man with dried blood etched on his face and shirt says to her, "They were students, just students. Whatever, what the fuck did they do to get this?" An older teacher tells the girl. They call for the return of the stolen 43. They have to be stolen, right? Who would spirit away 43 young men from the poorest parts of Mexico protesting discrimination, hiring, and funding practices? The images of the missing 43 and the flayed head she saw online are burned into her memories, and she cannot exorcise them, and soon she grows ill. The doctors cannot explain. She can no longer hold down food. Her skin turns yellow and begins to flake and break away like an ancient statue. On a Skype chat with her mother, she begs to come home. And from the comfort of her home in San Francisco, the girl's mother looks up private transports to and from airports and books a last-minute flight from Travelocity from Guerrero back to San Francisco. No transfers because price is no issue. A day later, with a car with tinted windows arrives to pick her up. They phone her to come outside and provide the safety word her mother emailed her the night before. The men are armed and speak fluent American English, and she begins to feel safe again. The word "it's not safe" from her mother's plea almost a year ago rings in her head as she sits in the back seat. She pulls out her phone and opens the blue Facebook app. The friends she made in Mexico are demonstrating in the capital. A sea of brown faces descends upon the capital that kings once ruled over. Their battle cry is one of truth and ideals. and thousands of people have photocopied pictures of the men onto their bodies, onto their shirts, and onto signs. Parents are distraught and calling out to the president, "Where is my son?" In various parts of the country, people march with them simultaneously. Protesters place 43 empty chairs in town squares, demanding that the president fill them with the missing men. Some women march naked, covering themselves with only the words written with a Sharpie or blood. They hold up faces, wear masks, and some of them hold up the photo of the man the girl saw online. Her Mexican friends don't censor the photo they posted as their profile picture. The girl is alarmed that Facebook hasn't removed the photo. It's too graphic after all. Another recurring image catches her eye, the same slogan spray painted in red all over the country. Vivos los llevaron, vivos los queremos. Image after image, she looks at each one carefully and sees a fire she has never seen before. When she scrolls down her timeline and finds an American friend, their photos are filled with Starbucks Frappuccinos, an announcement that it's rush week, someone is applying for an MFA, and her mother posts that Lulu finally had her puppies. She shuts off her phone and doesn't plan on opening it up anytime soon. She spends her time in her room during the winter break, and she doesn't turn on the TV, check her email, listen to the radio, read the newspaper, or check her Facebook account, her Twitter account. When someone comes to the door asking about her, her mother turns them away, replying that she's still sick. She contemplates taking the semester off or maybe taking an online class or two, but her grandmother's college fund only pays out if she attends full time. Her parents talk to her about returning, and during December, she finds solace in her high school Spanish textbook, Palabras. She looks at the dialogue in the book and remembers practicing with the other student in Miss Murphy's level one class freshman year. Hola, me llamo Lisa. ¿Cómo se llama usted? She says, tracing the words like a blind person traces Braille. A week into the spring semester, she waits for a large coffee at Pete's. There are two girls waiting at the counter. They attempt to order a secret menu drink that doesn't exist. They are complaining to the cashier and mention giving the coffee shop a bad Yelp review. Annoyed at the two girls bickering with the cashier, she turns on her phone and opens up Facebook for the first time since she came back to the university. A friend from Mexico has posted a picture of a woman marching. She is short in height, but large in the power that she commands, as she holds a sign that is a photo of a young man's face, and she wears a large t-shirt with the words, "Hijo, mientras no te entierren, te seguiré buscando." She knows these words, "Son, as long as we haven't buried you, I'll keep looking for you." Alone and separate, these words have no power, but when formed into sentences, they are rendered into life. She looks over to the girls who are returning their blended drink that had too little caramel drizzling and ground coffee beans in it. She marches to the counter and looks both girls in the eyes. The words dance on her tongue, but they are not her language. Her face turns red with fury. This is what you fucking care about. The world is not this here, she says as she takes a napkin from the counter, pulls out a Sharpie, and writes the man's name on it. Type this name as I've written it on your fucking computer. Go ahead, do it. She storms off, forgetting her drink as she walks to her class. She doesn't know if she wants to cry, run, scream, or punch someone in her face. She continues her march to class, triumphant in the thought that she said something. Maybe she should always say something. Maybe she should always care. The name burns in her pocket again. Its fire pricks at her skin, calling her to say something she doesn't know how to do or say. The girl wonders how she can translate this feeling. Can she? Is it even possible? A few hundred feet away, the same name burns in the pocket of a girl who complained about her drink. But this girl, this one, she throws the napkin away. Thank you.